Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Mommy Chronicles with Denise Davis May and Tanya Scott Williams, your parenting partners in raising phenomenal children.
Thank you for joining us for the Mommy Chronicles. I'm Tanya Scott Williams.
And I'm Denise Davis May.
During the 1960s, Americans watched as the ancestors of enslaved people, along with their allies, pushed back against oppressive systems, refusing to give in to seemingly unbridled rage launched against them. Their goal? Unfettered access to the rights ensured by the U.S. Constitution. They forged ahead against all odds to claim the ballot. Now, the Voting Rights Act, legislation that essentially prohibited racial discrimination in voting, essentially enforcing the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, was signed into law in 1965, a bitter victory consecrated by the blood, sweat, and tears of folks, many of whom have quietly faded into history. Today, we hope to revive some of those stories.
In light of the upcoming 50th commemoration of the Selma to Montgomery March, we are taking a closer look at the young people who witnessed those changing events firsthand. To help us do that, we've invited Dr. Darren E. Moten to be our guest. Dr. Moten received his Bachelor of Arts degree from Howard University in Washington, D.C., a Master of Science degree in Library Science from Catholic University of Washington, D.C., and a Master of Arts in American Studies from the University of Iowa, and then a PhD in American Studies from the University of Iowa. He's currently the acting chair in the Department of History and Political Science at the Alabama State University. Dr. Moten, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be on your show.
So, Dr. Moten, we talked, Tanya and I, quite a bit over the last couple of months about some of the issues related to voting rights. And when we talk about voting rights and the movement associated with it, are we speaking of a specific period in history? Can you talk to us a bit about that time frame?
Yes, I can. I suppose the effort for African Americans to secure voting rights began when the Founding Fathers sat down and drafted the original Constitution, because that original Constitution left out, as you well know, women, Native Americans, and African Americans. And so I think the quest actually began the very day that this country was founded, and that struggle continued for almost the next 200 years, and so it's been a very long and bitter struggle for African Americans. But as I tell my students, when Thomas Jefferson sat down and wrote the words of the Declaration of Independence when he said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." He didn't need to tell African Americans or women or Native Americans that, even though he was not speaking directly to them. They knew that the truth of liberty, freedom, was self-evident, and they knew freedom was associated with voting, with the ballot.
Reflections on this historic period, they generally focus on organizations, ministries, primarily adult spaces, but there were youth involved as well. And can you tell us a little bit about who they were?
There were all kinds of youth. There was, there were organized efforts and unorganized efforts. You had, for example, in so far as the organized efforts, you had the SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was mostly made up of young college students, but there were some high school students that participated in SNCC, although they may not have been able to formally be a member of SNCC. But you also had unorganized efforts. You had, for example, the unorganized efforts in St. Augustine, Florida, where black youth protested the Jim Crow laws in St. Augustine, particularly the segregated beaches. And so they had wade-ins where kids would just literally go out and wade in the water. And police officers would then have to go into the water and retrieve them. You also had youth who participated in the Birmingham confrontation. And there was also youth that participated in the Selma activities prior to Bloody Sunday, the efforts of public school teachers in Selma, black public school teachers in Selma, to register to vote, and their efforts were supported by their students.
I think one of the things that I've discovered, just as I've been, sort of reflecting on the history, of course, preparing for the show, things that I forget. I mean, we focus a lot of our attention on Alabama and Mississippi, those states in particular, but I'm so glad that you pointed out there were things happening all over this country. In Florida, I mean, I wasn't even aware of the situation in St. Augustine. But sometimes we bottle up this conversation into such a small space, it seems as if we fail to realize that this had wide and sweeping repercussions.
Absolutely, it did. And, there were many, and not M-A-N-Y, but M-I-N-I, civil rights demonstrations all across this country. I've done research about the desegregation of a public beach in Annapolis, Maryland, at Sandy Point State Park. There were students that participated in that demonstration. There was another demonstration that took place in Baltimore at Fort Smallwood Park, where black youth protested against the Jim Crow beaches. There were all kinds of protests across the country with respect to segregated swimming pools. People knew that Jim Crow was wrong. They never accepted the ruling from Plessy about separate and equal. People knew that separate meant unequal.
Mm-hmm. I think that we wanted on this show to definitely shine a light on some of those efforts, those that don't always get the attention, and then really to point out, I'm not sure about you, Dr. Moten, but personally, I think about how much courage it would take for, say, a 13-year-old to just say, no, I'm not going to do that. Just can't imagine what it would require, knowing what could potentially happen.
I am so happy you raised that issue, because I used to teach Melba Patillo Bills, Warriors Don't Cry. Melba Patillo was one of the nine high school students that integrated Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. And the last time I taught this book, I had a student who raised her hand, and she said, you know, Dr. Moten, integration ain't worth all that. And I just chuckled because, you know, those kids went through unholy, they were set upon from the moment they entered that school building to the moment they left that school building. And their life was a living, just a living nightmare. And, you know, I'm a parent, and I often think, would I have allowed my daughter or my son to be subjected to that type of treatment? And my initial response is no. There's no way in the world I would have put my child through something like that. These young people had unbelievable bravery. The students that that brave the lines, the sort of the going into the school, who brave the racial epithets, who brave, you know, people spitting on them. I mean, it took unbelievable courage. It took unbelievable self-discipline for those students to have gone through what they went through. And many of them are still among us, and I've heard them speak many years later, and some really question the wisdom of what they did and whether or not personally it was worth it.
So this speaks to an important point, I think. This discussion of the level of pain, of strife, of danger that these young people were placed in is just, I mean, it's unspeakable. But they were prepared, right, by...
Absolutely.
Some of the elders in the movement, even when the transition or the provision of support wasn't given easily or even voluntarily in some cases,
right,
given that what appears to have been some level of struggle of transitioning power, of training the next generation to participate in this activism, during this period, what would you consider to be some of the best practices for training young people to participate in this activism, training them for leadership during the voting rights movement?
Well, you know, our democracy is a participatory democracy. When I look back on history, the changes to the Constitution came as a result of a concerted effort by citizens of the United States pushing for those changes. You know, Frederick Douglass once said that power concedes nothing without a demand. I agree with Frederick Douglass. And so, you know, I'm heartened because, you know, young people didn't need me to instruct them what they should do when the situation occurred in Ferguson. They didn't need me to instruct them what to do when the situation occurred in Florida with Trayvon Martin. And so, you know, people know when something is wrong. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think, you know, the youth have, social media has been a great tool for orchestrating and organizing events. There are a number of young community activists, many of whom operate under the radar. And so they're out there talking to their to their friends. And as I said, social media has been a great outlet for people to communicate their views and to galvanize around certain issues. There are also the more traditional venues, schools, churches, civic organizations, and so those entities are still available. But, you know, as I said, I think, you know, I have taken encouragement from how quickly young people have been able to organize. And, you know, with the situation with Michael Brown, I was absolutely flabbergasted that there were protests literally across this country, many sort of spearheaded by young people. I think that's admirable.
Yes, certainly. And this point of around social media and some of the new ways in which young people both know and do what's necessary to respond to injustice is a point I want us to kind of continue. But we're going to take a quick break. I'm going to give you a couple of seconds, not minutes, to think about some of the prominent social media platforms that you're aware of, and even some of the community activists that you might be aware of that might help some of the folks in our audience begin to tap into some of what young people are participating in. If you're just joining us, our guest today on the Mommy Chronicles is Dr. Darren E. Moten. He's the acting chair in the Department of History and Political Science at The Alabama State University. Our topic today, voting rights youth, bearing witness to history's youngest champion.
Southern Song by Margaret Walker. I want my body bathed again by southern suns, my soul reclaimed again from southern land. I want to rest again in southern fields, and grass and hay and clover bloom, to lay my hand again upon the clay baked by southern sun, to touch the rain-soaked earth and smell the smell of soil. I want my rest unbroken in the fields of southern earth, freedom to watch the corn wave silver in the sun and mark the splashing of a brook, a pond with ducks and frogs and count the clouds. I want no mobs to wrench me from my southern rest, no forms to take me in the night and burn my shack and make for me a nightmare full of oil and flame. I want my careless song to strike no minor key, no fiend to stand between my body's southern song, the fusion of the South, my body's song and me.
So, Dr. Moten, I really would like to pick back up on that point of around social media and the idea of contemporary community activists and some of the media through which they are embarking on this activism. Do you have any that you can identify?
Well, we had a young man on our campus a few weeks ago, and frankly, or and honestly, you know, shortly prior to his arrival on our campus, I really had not heard of him. This young man is well known. He has a huge following, social media following. His name is Philip Agnew. He's part of something called the Dream Defenders. And he was absolutely remarkable. And he reminded me of those days, you know, when I was a undergraduate student and we would all sit around in the student union and debate this point or debate that point or whatever. And so, you know, he would certainly be one of these young student leaders. He's a graduate of Florida A&M University. But as I said, you know, he sort of he became involved as a result of what happened in Florida with Trayvon Martin, and just has continued to sort of rail against injustice. And you know, we need everybody. You know, I have a dear friend and someone whom I greatly respect, who is an attorney here in Montgomery. His name is Brian Stevenson. He has a nonprofit law firm called Equal Justice Initiative. And Brian has just written a book. The title of the book is Just Mercy. Brian and I are contemporaries, and so we cannot be considered youth. However, you know, Brian is out there, battling the curmudgeons of the world, the principalities of the world, and we need thousands of Brian Stevenson. So we need young and old to push back against the injustices that still exist in the land of the free and the home of the brave.
And to be brave, oh, to be brave. What are some of the strategies that we might use to begin to make those transitions? You just said that we need both young and old, but what, at least in my opinion, what I continue to see is that the bridge has not been joined. You have the elder activist on one side of the bridge, focusing on one particular method to achieve a goal, and some of the younger activists on the other side of the bridge focusing on the same goal, using different strategies, and no merger between the two. How would you suggest that we begin to bridge these groups?
Well, you know, if I may, I'd like to answer the first part of your question. You know, how do we do this? I mean, I think one of the things that we need to do is that we need to be informed. And you know, it might sound this might strike some of the listeners as funny, but we need students who read. We really do need them to be informed. It's good to be passionate, but we need to have informed passion. Ishmael Reed wrote a essay called Killer Illiteracy, and he says that illiteracy in the African-American community and the community of color is more diabolical than drugs and guns and alcohol. And so we need literate folks. I'm not talking about, you know, people who know their ABCs, but I mean we need people who are informed, who are because that's what's going to help us. I mean, so there's that component. The other part is I think we have to be respectful. I'm of the generation when I first started teaching at Alabama State in 1996. I used to stand in class thinking, well, there's not much difference between me and my students. Well, I no longer feel that way. I no longer say that because I know there's like chasms that separate my. But I respect the position of my students. And so Dr. King didn't always agree with SNCC. SNCC didn't always agree with SCLC. But they found a way to work together. CORE didn't always agree with SCLC or the NAACP, but they found a way to work together. And so I think that what we have to do is find a way to work together because, you know, we do have a common objective, and the common objective, it seems to me, is that we are all working for equal justice, equal opportunities, and equal rights for all. And however we get there is less important than the fact that we get there, because it is about equal opportunity, equal justice, and equal rights for all.
And if I might add to your statement about having youth who read, I strongly agree with that. Being informed and knowing, being able to discern the times and understanding, being able to connect that to past events so that they can perhaps maybe pick up on patterns and be able to move forward with that. But I'd also like to add being able to talk to your elders, allowing them the freedom to share with you stories that you may never have heard before. Right. I remember when you and I talked last week, and I tell you, I could have talked to you all afternoon if you had allowed me, but it was such an engaging conversation because you brought up such an important point. You talked about the microaggressions that a lot of the children during the movement witnessed, either dealing with their parents or in their own personal lives. Can you speak to some of those stories?
Share
a little bit about some of those things, and then allow our audience to realize that these folks are around us today, and they're carrying these stories, and would be willing to share.
Absolutely. One of my favorite writings by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is his letter from Birmingham Jail, where he talks about in that letter that, you know, your mother is your grandmother or your mother is called auntie. Your father is referred to as boy. They're never referred to as Mr. or Mrs. They're never referred to or they're often referred to by their first name. And, you know, those are indignities that our elders face daily, constantly. Sometimes alone, but very often in the company of either their child or children or grandchild or grandchildren, and they had to but they endured those types of indignities. You know, I have a colleague now retired who tells a story about when he was a kid and in Birmingham, and he was walking down the sidewalk with his mother, and a police officer was approaching them, and he was twirling his billy club, and he stuck his billy club in my friend's stomach and pushed him off the sidewalk and said, "Get off the sidewalk," because there was once upon a time blacks had to cede the sidewalk to whites in order to let whites pass before they could get back onto the sidewalk. I mean, those types of indignities. And, you know, it might seem minuscule, it might seem trivial today, given that we don't have these mandates or social etiquette or whatever. But it had a lasting impact on our elders, and so, you know, understanding those types of insensitivities and those indignities that our elders endured, I think should make us appreciate more the fact that we don't have to endure these things. I mean, we have other indignities that we deal with, but we don't have to endure and deal with those types of indignities. And so I think there's a lot that we can learn. I mean, the fact that, you know, we have an African-American president and an African-American first family in the White House. And, you know, it's mind-boggling for someone my age to think that we would actually be at this place at this time. But then, you know, another one of my favorite speeches by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is the one that he gave here in Montgomery at the end of the Selma to Montgomery March, when Dr. King engaged in something called called and response. Dr. King said, "We will not have to wait long for our rights." And someone in the crowd said, "Well, how long, Doc?" He said, "Not long, because truth pressed, the earth will rise again." And someone said, well, how long? And he says, not long, because the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And someone asked, how long? And he said, not long, because no lie lives forever. And someone said, how long? And he said, not long, because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. And so, you know, there's a lot of wisdom that we can learn from our elders. And that's our armor. You know, I mean, that's what protects us. Because
yes.
if we know what they endured, there is absolutely no reason why we should hang our heads.
Mm.
I mean, absolutely no reason at all.
A lot of these stories I remember hearing growing up. My grandmother didn't share a whole lot, but she shared enough to help us get through. I'm sure there were some things that she would just prefer not to share. But as I was preparing for the show, I did purposefully bring up onto our website and on Facebook images of children during the movement.
Right.
And I scanned through a lot of pictures. And
right.
I was moved in so many ways because those are not pleasant images to see.
Right.
12
right.
and 13-year-olds, sometimes younger than that, being arrested, pressed to the ground.
Right.
There's one image of a mother who's standing between, I'm assuming she's a mother, but she's standing between a crowd on the left and two little girls on the right, and I guess she's maybe ushering them into school or something, but the look of panic in their faces.
Right.
And knowing that these elders may still be with us today, and they're holding on to those stories,
right.
it would help us to understand so much more that is not being said. The feelings, as Denise has said before, those soul memories,
right.
those things are there, and they influence a lot of what we have begun to accept as the norm. And those memories, they need to be shared with anyone who's willing to listen. And I would ask our audience members, if you've got your uncles and your aunts and your grandmothers who are with you, your neighbors, your church members,
right.
you know,
right.
respectfully ask them to share just
right.
some part of their history, and you would
right.
be amazed at the things that you'll take away from that.
Right. People who remember Emmett Till understood a Trayvon Martin. You know, and when you think about the fact that during the movement, even youth weren't protected. And that, you know, the four girls that were killed in that church bombing, that you know, if you can't protect the babies from this violence, and we couldn't, we tried, and so, you know, there were. I mean, it just points to, and I can remember, I can see in my mind Roy Wilkins talking about Mississippi in the wake of Emmett Till's death, and my dad, who was in his 20s, went to the wake to see Emmett Till's body, and. You know, that memory stayed with him all of his life. And some many years later, after I started teaching here, I was, and this was early on in my teaching at Alabama State, I had a class over in the library, and I explained to them when Jet published the corpse of Emmett Till, that was one of the first times that a photo like that had ever appeared in print. And so it was very controversial. And so many of my students said, well, we've never seen this. And so I found the microfilm for that particular issue of Jet, and I put it on the microfilm reader printer and turned it on. Well, if you recall how reader printers work, especially the old reader printers, the image sort of fades in. It doesn't appear instantly. And so all my students were sort of hovered around the screen, and then the picture faded in, and it got clearer and clearer. And as it became more and more clear, they all leaned back. And they said, oh, my God. Because they had never seen that photo before. Now with their cell phones and everything, everybody could just Google it. But so, you know, those you know, we shouldn't forget the Emmett Till's. We shouldn't forget the Addie Mae Collins and the Carol Denise McNairs and the Cynthia Wesleys and the Carol Robinsons. We shouldn't forget because, you know, there were many martyrs in this movement.
And we certainly can't forget, and we're still unable to fully protect our babies.
Yes, we are.
And so we'll talk a little bit about how we move this into contemporary a contemporary discussion. And we're going to take a quick break.
Thank you for tuning in today for the Mommy Chronicles. I'm Tanya Scott Williams.
And I'm Denise Davis May.
If you missed the first part of our show, be sure to log in to the archives on Blog Talk Radio. You'll not only find today's episode, but you'll also have an opportunity to listen to past shows. If you'd like to suggest a topic, write to us at mommychronicles2014@gmail.com. We're also on Facebook, and we're also on Twitter.
Langston Hughes, I Too Sing America. I Too Sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when the company comes. But I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow I'll be at the table when the company comes. Nobody will dare say to me, eat in the kitchen. Then, besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I, too, am America.
We are so glad to have an opportunity to talk with you today, Dr. Moten, especially considering that we're moving into the commemoration of the Voting Rights Act, the Selma to Montgomery March, and all of the fantastic activities surrounding that that are planned not only for Montgomery but also for Selma. And so we just felt that it was so important for us to join into that conversation and then allow for space for us, for our audience, to reflect on the lives of some of those youngest warriors, those babies, as you said, who participated either as groups or if they just made individual decisions to say, today, you know, today I'm not going to do that today.
Right.
There's a whole lot to be said about that, and as Denise said, we'd also like to find out how we can bridge that gap. Not only allow for conversation with those elders who are still with us, but then encourage there to be a transition to some degree of the baton to pass it on to the next generation.
Right.
And we want you to speak to some of the ways in which you've spoken to the fact that the young people who knew there was something wrong, whether it was in relationship to the tragedy of Trayvon Martin or the other Jordan Davis or any of the number of tragedies that have occurred over the last 3 years, they knew and they acted.
Right. Right.
I'm sorry. What is the means to making sure that our young people are safe in their action? We couldn't protect them in 1965. And in some ways, when I hear the stories of the young folks who traveled to Ferguson, we really didn't do a great job of protecting them in 2014. So what are some of the ways that we can begin to prepare them to not only act, but to act in ways that will keep them alive?
Boy, you know, I think we have to inveigh these laws that I feel are unnecessary but are put our communities and those who live in our communities at greater risk. These stand your ground laws are just it gives someone a right that we need to go back and I think as a community, as a society, and rethink because, you know, whatever the jury decided in Florida, Mark Zimmerman shot and killed an unarmed child.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And we are saying that there is a law that protects an adult to shoot and kill an unarmed child. I don't think we want to be in a society or to say that this is the society or the type of society that we want to live in, where an adult has a legal right to shoot and kill an unarmed child.
Mm-hmm.
I also think, similarly, we need to question the efficacy of shoot-to-kill mandates, or I shouldn't say mandates, but police having the authority to shoot-to-kill. Because what many people do not know is that in many police departments across this land, police officers are trained to shoot-to-kill. In other
mm-hmm.
words, if a police officer removes her weapon, her intent is not the main. Her intent is to shoot to kill. And we, you know, and so, you know, again, when we think about Michael Brown, was it necessary to kill Michael Brown? And so, you know, those types of things, I think, as adults, as parents, as citizens, as voters, I think we should question. Because we have a, truth be told, we have a right, we have a stand your ground law right here in Alabama. So what happened to Trayvon Martin could have happened in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
There is a whole lot in that. I hardly even know where to start. I just don't. You know, and there are so many others who are listening to us today who perhaps maybe feel the same way or maybe have some answers. So we invite you all to continue the conversation. Certainly, if you want to participate with us today, you're welcome to call in as a guest. The number is 646-716-6978. We have about 15 minutes or so before we will conclude today's show, but this conversation doesn't have to stop today. We can carry it on in our homes, in our workplaces, in our houses of worship, and we hope that you will do that because there is a lot to be dealt with, but we can remember that we come from good stock, good people. You know, there's greatness in our DNA. I quote that from a poem that actually my husband wrote, and it has encouraged us in our household. There's greatness in us, and we can walk in the footsteps of those who've gone before us, and we don't have to walk alone. We have allies across all races and all faiths, and if we work together, we can see even more changes. We're not there yet. God knows who we are, not there yet. But we can see more changes. Many things today we're living that our parents didn't expect to see. Our grandparents certainly didn't expect to see. Places that we live, schools that we go to, vacations that we take, beaches that we go to, don't even think twice about it. I know
right.
I don't.
Right.
Pools that we access, public spaces that were once closed off to us, those places, those are the things that our parents and our grandparents never expected to have in their lifetime. But we have that now. And we have that now because good folks decided that they wanted to come together in small ways and large ways and make a difference. It seems as if we have a caller, so we'll go to the lines right now. Good morning. You're on the Mommy Chronicles. Who may I say is calling?
Good morning. This is Rick Williams. How are you all doing?
Well.
Hi. Hello.
The one thing I want you all to address, because I think it keeps getting overlooked over and over again with the Trayvon Martin situation, is the fact that Zimmerman was told by the 911 operator to not follow. So how then can you have a stand your ground defense when he was told by the 911 operator not to follow? So anything, it would seem to me, that happens after that point was because of his aggression, not standing the ground, but his pursuit.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I was absolutely outraged when the defense attorney, during his closing argument, literally picked up a portion of the sidewalk and said to the jury, this was Trayvon Martin's weapon. I mean, I almost lost my mind.
I'll say the caller just now brings up a good point, and also in to fully disclose that actually was my husband, Rick Williams, who apparently is listening to the show from the office, and we do thank him for that call-in and invite any others who may want to participate in these few minutes before we have to conclude today's session. I want to also point out that the poetry recited today during our breaks was contributed by Daraja May, who also actually sang our opening song for us, and by Lydia Williams.
Beautiful voice.
Very good. Yes, awesome. For a list of the poems that they've shared today, we ask that you write to us at mommychronicles2014@gmail.com, and we will gladly send you a copy of those poems and the lists of the names of the poets that they recited.
And we also would like you to email us at mommychronicles2014@gmail.com with any stories, any information you'd like to share. We're looking forward to hearing from you. We're excited to continue this discussion with Dr. Moten, and we'll take a quick break.
Govern Yourself Accordingly by Kalamu Ya Salaam. I have dismissed the minister of emotional defenses, distributed confetti to all the guards, and given faithful and ever-vigilant caution several days off. The city of me is well ready to joyously receive and rainbow-celebrate your unanticipated but nonetheless profoundly appreciated arrival into the intimacy of our space. Know that you are warmly welcomed for howsoever long you should choose to stay here. You need no keys, no doors locked to you. Every window is open. Feel free.
So, we have a couple more questions. We want to make sure, Dr. Moten, that if you have any other points that you want to make, feel free to make them as we begin to move toward our conclusion of the program this morning. I do have sort of a burning question for you,
yes.
Particularly as it relates to the training. And you'll note that I keep going back to how do we get our young folk where they need to be. I, too, am an educator by day and am really interested in seeing our young people engage in more than cursory sound bites.
Yes.
You know, the 75-word tweet. And even though these forms of media provide an opportunity to engage,
yes,
in ways that we certainly could never have seen 25 or 40 years ago,
yes,
I really want them to be prepared. This idea that they have to be well-read, that's certainly pertinent. But what are the kinds of tasks or opportunities, volunteer opportunities even, that we might engage young folk in so that we're preparing them as they're becoming, as they create more depth in their knowledge base by reading?
Well, I think we have to introduce them to the numerous injustices in the world. I think we have to take them to places of incarceration. I think we have to take them to camps where migrant laborers work. I think we have to take them to the extent that we can get inside of these places to some of these meat processing plants to let them see the work conditions in these plants. I think we have to show them what this is like, and what discrimination, what unfairness looks like, and then we have to challenge them and challenge ourselves. We got to make this better. We have to make this right.
There is always an opportunity for us to reach out to whoever is close to us and begin to share with them steps that you suggested, certainly going into some of these spaces, because it makes it clear. It takes it off the TV screen, and it brings it into real life.
Yes.
And it allows us to realize that this is every day. This is the everyday stuff that a lot of people are dealing with. And it also will add not just passion to the movement, because the movement is still afoot, by the way, but it will help to inform in a way that allows for efforts to be more focused. Everybody's not going to do the same thing. Thank God for that, because we all have spaces that we are better equipped to move in.
Right.
But we can all move in a direction that's going to eventually be better for this entire nation, because just think about it. If we could work together as a nation, bringing all the talents to the forefront, how much stronger, we're already a strong nation, how much stronger we would be.
Right.
And the idea of this practical application, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because what that does is to link or to bridge the theory. All of this discourse, we can talk until we are blue in the face. If folks don't understand on the ground how people live these experiences, then it won't necessarily inform the movement. And then the movement will miss its mark, as it has done in the past. And so I'm really glad that you mentioned that. This idea of making sure that young people are reading, certainly, but also connecting with the ongoing issues, the issues of prisons and prisons being a business. The idea that, you know, there's a reason why we build more prisons than schools. The idea that migrant workers are at the same time maligned as they are mistreated in workspaces. So understanding all of that, I think, is certainly important, and I'm so glad you mentioned it. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
I've known rivers. Ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans. And I've seen its mighty bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
If you're just joining us, this is the Mommy Chronicles, and we'd like to thank you so much for tuning in today. And we do ask that you go to our website, go to our Facebook page, of course, to like us and to follow us online. Musical accompaniment from the website for the poems today came from freemusicarchive.org, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution from the following artists: Cooper Moore and his song H Ballad for Piano Mixed 2, Keith Helt and his song St. Genevieve, Thinking by Madoda Ogitani, Kai Ingles' Walking Stars, and Chris Zabriskie's Prelude No. 8. We're so grateful that there is information and resources that's available to the public, free and online, and so you may want to go to some of those sites if you have a project of your own, if you'd like to have a musical accompaniment.
And again, we'd like to thank both Lydia Williams and Daraja May for those wonderful recitations of poems that are central to the experience of Africans in America. We will continue our discussion with our wonderful guest. He's so enlightened both of us on so much this morning, Dr. Moten. Are there any other points that you'd like to make that we haven't addressed so far?
Well, no, I don't think there's anything we haven't addressed that I think has been overlooked. But I would like to say that I really like the remarks that Dr. King made at Holt Street Baptist Church on the eve of the Montgomery bus boycott, because one of the things that he said, that he said the greatness of America is the right to protest for rights. And I think people should understand that what happened in Selma, what it signifies, exemplifies the greatness of America, because we have the right to protest for rights. And that's what those people did in Selma. That's what they did in Montgomery. That's what they did in Birmingham. And so from my point of view, you know, what these events that took place in Alabama are as significant to this American democracy as what happened at Lexington and Concord and Boston for our new democracy. And so, you know, these events were extremely important. This is not about great speeches. This is not about, you know, snarling dogs and water hoses or whatever. This was about correcting wrongs. And the reason why we refer to our Constitution as a living Constitution is because it was written by human beings. It was flawed when it was first written. It's not perfect, but we're far better now than we were initially.
So thank you again, Dr. Moten. Next week is the 50th commemoration of Bloody Sunday, the Voting Rights Act, and the Selma to Montgomery March. You'll want to visit both cities to take in the events that are being held to highlight this important period in American and, in fact, world history. While activities are posted on various websites, we've relied heavily on www.selma50.com and dreammarcheson.com. Please do check those websites. There are wonderful activities numbering in the 20s for youth, for college students, for elders. So do check the website. There are a bunch of things going on between Selma and Montgomery and Lowndes County. Next week is going to be a phenomenal week.
Yes.
So we implore you to get involved.
Mm-hmm. And we hope to be there. Well, we're going to be there individually, but we hope to be there as the Mommy Chronicles on site, just being in that space and participating in this wonderful time in world history. So be on the lookout for us and our station. Also, bring someone else along, not just your family, but bring a neighbor, a child who may not otherwise have an opportunity to go, because this is so important. And like you said, Dr. Moten, it's not about great speeches. It's about so much more. And we cannot thank you enough for agreeing to be our guest today. We have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with you today.
We are
More
than thankful.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. I thoroughly enjoyed it myself.
If you'd like to, as I said, get an archive of today's show, you can always go to Blog Talk Radio and look up our posts. We are the Mommy Chronicles, Denise Davis May and Tanya Scott Williams, and we are so grateful to our audience for that we've had over this past year as we've been slowly developing the Mommy Chronicles and its reach. And we could not move forward without all the encouragement and the support that we've gotten from the community.
We thank you, and we look forward to next month. Be sure to continue to communicate with us via email, via Facebook, and even Twitter. Take care and have a wonderful, progressive week.
Thanks for listening to The Mommy Chronicles with Denise Davis May and Tanya Scott Williams. Listen anytime, anywhere on blogtalkradio.com. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Write to us at mommychronicles2014@gmail.com. The Mommy Chronicles, your parenting partners in raising phenomenal children.